Mayor Curry goes to Washington to demand action on Eureka Garden. Congresswoman Corrine Brown breaks her silence. And could the Puerto Rico debt crisis engulf Jaxport? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand at tvjax.com. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, we speak with former CIA agent Valerie Plame. Find out why she's in town and speaking right here at WJCT next week. Then later on, blues great Mud Morganfield, the son of Muddy Waters. He'll be in studio. Don't miss the preview of his free concert tonight on Amelia Island. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable here today. Sebastian Kitchen of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tim Gibbons, editor with the Jacksonville Business Journal, is here.
Good to be here.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hi, Fred. And our own WJCT analyst, John Burr.
Happy Friday.
It is. It certainly is. And lots of news from a busy week to discuss. From Corrine Brown breaking her silence to the new Jaguars draft pick and a whole lot more. Busy week. But first this morning, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry and City Councilman Garrett Dennis flew to Washington the other day for a sit-down with HUD Secretary Julian Castro. By the way, Castro is a likely vice presidential pick for Hillary Clinton, but that's another story. In terms of Jacksonville's concerns, Castro assured the mayor and the councilman that the feds will aggressively push the owner of the troubled Eureka Garden housing complex and other apartments that Global Ministries owns to repair serious problems, making living conditions deplorable for residents there. Chief among them, mold, but also bedbugs, roaches, leaking toilets, decaying stairs, gas leaks. We want your calls on this and the top stories of the week, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. Fred Matthews, do you think the mayor and the councilman going to meet with Castro will make a difference?
It makes makes for great optics. He had a phone call with him and certainly with the office over the last few months concerning this. So it's a nice thing to do. The difference is still in the hands of HUD, and their only stick, quite frankly, is to terminate the contract of Global Ministries. But in looking at the optics on the ground here, looking at at-large Councilman Tommy Hazzouri walking through Washington Heights the other week with the fire inspector Kevin Jones, it is evident to anybody that the city of Jacksonville has power to close a number of the apartment complexes. They always have. Kevin Jones has the power as inspector to say, hey, this fire thing is not in place. We need to close this building. We need to close this office. Code enforcement all the time goes into places and says, hey, the ceiling's falling in. This is going on. This place needs to be condemned. I mean, the city of Jacksonville has the power to do a number of things. They simply can't take the ownership away, but they can do it. Now, the problem that's evident to everybody is, what are you going to do with the residents?
Where do they go? Tim Gibbons.
That is the problem. And it's interesting. You mentioned code enforcement. And, you know, living in an older neighborhood and knowing people who, you know, have issues with their homes, the idea that the city can't do anything is clearly not true. But what you said at the end there, so what do you do with them? Code enforcement can go in and shut it down, and then you have a bunch of people going where? The city isn't going to pick up the tab to put them anywhere else. As many people have said, we have an issue with affordable housing in the city, and this is, you know, the idea that this is better than nothing. Mm-hmm.
Sebastian Kitchen, that is the larger issue. There are a serious shortage of affordable rental units in Jacksonville and around Florida. That is a bigger problem, and one that deserves more attention.
And that is an issue. As they discuss this, it's easy to say you want to shut them down or you want to take away that federal funding. But again, then do you lose that funding, or are those people distributed into the community where they cannot afford to live? And Councilman Dennis told the Times Union that is one of the issues he brought up with the secretary, not just Eureka Garden, but just the issue with affordable housing and mm-hmm. programs that they hopefully at some point can bring to Jacksonville to help with affordable housing. But apparently, you know, according to the mayor and according to the councilman, the secretary Castro told them that, you know, they cannot force Eureka Garden to sell, so they can put pressure on them. The mayor said, we can keep this in the headlines, but they cannot force them to sell. Now, what they can do is I think Fred alluded to, that they can withdraw that money. Eureka Garden doesn't want to see that more than $6 million a year that they receive in taxpayer funding from D.C. go away. But no, they cannot force them to sell.
Just a week or two ago, we hosted Ability Housing on this program to talk about the Fair Housing Summit that was held down in Orlando earlier this month. And at the top of that meeting's agenda was this problem of finding affordable housing, or what's also called workforce housing, for people that can only pay so much in rent, but there are no rents anywhere near their ability to pay, unless they go to a complex like this one, John, which is deplorable in so many ways.
Yeah, and there you have the, you know, the catch-22 there. But, you know, I think there's some significance in the housing secretary agreeing to see Lenny Curry. I mean, he doesn't have to see Lenny Curry, but he said, sure, I'll talk to you about it. I think that kind of sets up a dynamic where, you know, maybe HUD at the last, as a last resort, does some sort of emergency action and takes over Eureka Gardens. You know, obviously, if you agree to meet with the mayor, you're also saying, hey, we're willing to help you with this. You know, I got to give Curry credit for this. I mean, you know, Fred's right. I mean, the city could have done any number of things with Eureka Gardens and other places over the years, but, you know, they didn't.
And Jimmy tweets the show, not good enough to just distribute more Section 8 vouchers. We must build new low-income housing stock.
We're not going to do that. I mean, we entered it in the 80s, I think, yeah, 90s. 80s, or 90s. In the 80s. There was a big hullabaloo here about public housing and about the subject of scattered housing and the fact that we had to move in order to the downtown, for those of you who don't remember, across from the Ritz Theater, there used to be a big place called
Blodgett
Homes. Mm-hmm. There for many, many years. There was a big debate about what are we going to do about it. It's crime infested, all of this. Past Sheriff Nat Glover grew up there. So they decided that they would demolish all of that, scatter the residents all around the city. Every neighborhood would have to take some of them. And we argued, I don't want them in my neighborhood. So we did, but we demolished it anyway. And we created a small little Blodgett villa there for those who could behave themselves in public housing. And thus we had these apartment complexes like what you have now. You have those who could go to rental housing, and we still don't have a number of neighborhoods who will take persons with a Section 8 voucher if they find out about it. They're not going to have that home in their neighborhood.
We've even had issues with nonprofits like Ability Housing trying to house homeless veterans because of that.
That's right.
Very dynamic. And I know, Tim, you want to comment, but let me get to this call and the number to join us, 549-2937. Katie in Jacksonville. Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi, my question is about mold. I've read the Property Safety Maintenance Code and reviewed the website of the Department of Health, and it seems to me that there is no entity or organization in Jacksonville that actually addresses mold in housing.
Well, it's because you're going to end up having to either tear the house down or rip out every wall.
Yeah, you can't. Once mold takes hold, there's not a lot you can do beyond tearing down or gutting the place. And that is a serious intractable problem. And it's one. And Tim, it's one that they've had at Eureka Garden for a long time.
They have. I mean, anywhere in Florida that's not taken care of properly is going to have it. And the problem, as Fred says, is this. Housing, low-income housing is a problem that we haven't solved. And we pretty much mean, you know, as a country, the idea that projects don't work. That was pretty much conclusively proved in the 70s and 80s. Section 8 housing gives weird incentives to landlords, creates issues there, and there's just neighborhoods they won't go into. A lot of times you end up with nonprofits like the one running Eureka Gardens doing it, because the idea is that they have the societal mission. If they're not doing it well, that's kind of the last resort.
Mm. Well, we want your calls on this, but also we're going to move on and discuss the other top stories of the week as we move on to the debt crisis in Puerto Rico and how that is affecting Jacksonville. Give us a call about that. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, on Wednesday, Senator Marco Rubio took to the Senate floor, and he said that Jacksonville could suffer an economic blow if the government doesn't bail out Puerto Rico. The American territory has a debt payment looming in May, which it probably won't be able to meet. We're talking about $422 million. That's just the first payment Puerto Rico owes. If they cannot meet that obligation, it could push Puerto Rico and its 3.5 million American citizens into even deeper crisis. We are talking about a fiscal and humanitarian disaster. It is seriously a bad situation down there. But what does it mean for us? Well, about 75% of the goods that come in and out of Puerto Rico also flow through Jaxport. That brings $1 billion worth of economic impact to this city every year. So this is one that Jaxport and local officials and our senators are watching closely. Sebastian.
Now, the senator on the floor was referencing a Sunday story in the Times Union where Drew Dixon looked at what a large, large trade partner that Puerto Rico is for Jacksonville. And Jacksonville is not as large of a port as some of the other ports in the southeast. And so that's a critical, critical trading partner. And so the fact that there are fewer and fewer people in Puerto Rico and those people have fewer and fewer dollars to spend could have huge implications in Jacksonville if you know, they cannot ship more of those goods to Puerto Rico because there's not the market to do it. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that works out. And especially as Congress continues to debate what they're going to do about it, I think the members of Congress know that something needs to be done, but don't necessarily just want to hand them a bailout. So it's also a political issue in Washington.
Right. That Congress isn't inclined to rescue Puerto Rico, apparently.
Congress isn't inclined to do much these days and probably won't do much till after November 6th. But, you know, this is an issue for Jaxport. But, you know, it's also an issue for Florida because beyond Jacksonville, what all this economic deterioration in Puerto Rico means is that we're getting thousands upon thousands of people from Puerto Rico coming to Florida and settling here, which has got all kinds of dynamics to it also. So this is a very long, far-reaching problem.
The Business Journal did a story on this probably about a year ago and looking at kind of both sides of the coin, that clearly there's the impact on the shipper, on the shipping community, the entire, you have Crowley and SeaStar and Trailer Bridge and all these companies that basically are the main carriers of things to Puerto Rico. On the other hand, you have all the economic ties of people from here sending money over there, companies from there doing work here. In some ways, as the economy there has gone bad, we've had an influx that has actually bolstered not as much Jacksonville as places like Tampa, but even here as well.
Well, I mean, it's ironic. I mean, everybody does realize that we own Puerto Rico, right? I mean, it is a territory of the United States.
Those are U.S. citizens.
I mean,
yes, sir.
This is not something that they simply don't have a vote in Congress, but it is ours, you know. And this is not new news. It's been brewing for several years. Yeah. Puerto Rico is on the brink of looking just like Greece. It's just interesting to finally see our junior senator actually on the floor making statements. So he's been as
there
a
are a large number of Puerto Ricans in Florida,
that
have come here in part because there's not enough economic opportunity in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I mean their chief business is tourism. And the shipping business. Aside from that, there's nothing going on there.
It used to be pharmaceutical, isn't it?
Yeah,
they changed some tax laws, and the pharmaceutical industry just totally pulled out. And tourism actually has been dropping off there as well. So you end up with their main industry is basically, you know, nothing.
There you go. And that is the crux of the debt crisis. They still have millions of people to feed. They've got public housing issues. They've got food issues. And there's no money.
And, you know, about a month or two ago, I interviewed Nelson Dennis, the author of a book called War Against All Puerto Ricans. A fascinating book for anyone that's interested in learning about Puerto Ricans' unsuccessful armed insurrection against the United States back in 1950. And he also talked about something that a lot of Americans haven't followed because of the law that requires that every ship that goes into San Juan have a U.S. flag. That has crippled Puerto Rico industry, is the contention, the argument that he makes.
Which
in
is not
book.
An argument that the Jacksonville shipping industry would
and
kindly
and he was absolutely at odds with the Jacksonville shipping industry, saying that Puerto Rico is structurally disadvantaged against ports like Jaxport. That was his argument.
The idea is that the Jones Act basically is designed to, you know, have us have a shipping industry. Otherwise, you'd have basically foreign carriers building all of our ships and operating all of our ships.
You know, Puerto Rico is not in the position to be fundamentally at odds with anybody
these days. They need help right now.
Yeah, maybe that's the trade-off. They become the 51st straight, and we bail them out. You know.
Well, they've had several close referendums getting there, and they have not passed. Mm-hmm. And again, as you said, John, there's no sympathy in Congress for this right now. There's just none. Senator Rubio should have been dealing with this if he was really that interested years ago when he first got in.
That is the amazing thing from a political standpoint. The idea that, you know, Rubio is known for not having been active in the
Senate. Let's talk about that, because now that Rubio's out in the presidential stakes, all of a sudden we're seeing him pop up in his official role as senator.
He met this week with people on Eureka Garden because he was in Washington to meet with them. He spoke on the floor about the issue He spoke on the floor about Puerto Rico. So it's a lot more active Marco Rubio
than I
remember.
Which leads one to wonder how he might be. He's doing his job, but is he also positioning himself for something in four more years?
He's a bright young man. He should run for president.
There's an idea.
Okay, let's keep taking your calls at 549-2937. As we talk a minute about Congresswoman Corrine Brown, now this week she broke her silence about the controversy swirling around her office, both about a federal ethics investigation into a questionable charity that she is involved with, and also her plans to seek re-election in the newly redrawn 5th Congressional District. Brown will run again, and she is taking her redistricting fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, she says. Now, Brown told our news partner Channel 4 and reporter Jim Pigott that she's extremely upset and thinks she's being unfairly targeted and singled out. Take a listen.
I am upset. I'm upset. I've talked to several people in the Jacksonville area that there have been grand jury investigations. They had never read anything in the paper. They have not seen it on the news. So there is, and the grand jury investigation should be and supposed to be closed. So even though I am not saying anything about it, somebody is talking. And my staff don't want me to say a witch hunt. That is an organized effort to take me out of office. And of course, the community knows about it. And it's not a secret. People are going around saying, we're going to get rid of her.
Corrine Brown saying that she believes there's a leak from the investigation. We have been reading about this in particular in the Florida Times-Union. Sebastian Kitchen, what about her comments?
I don't know how it's not closed or what is leaked. There were some aspects, though, that obviously it doesn't look like there was a large effort on the part of the federal government and the U.S. Attorney's Office to conceal what's going on. She was served her subpoena in a restaurant. I imagine she's a public official. There would have been other ways they could have found her when she was not around other people. But a lot of the information that's come out publicly has been information that once the Florida Times Union was aware that she had been served, started looking into the money that went into her campaign, money that went out, and some of her doings. And that's where a lot of the reporting that's been done was not from the grand jury, was not from the federal government. It was from reporting that looked at documents to see how much money was going to that nonprofit. And since then, the head of that nonprofit has pled guilty, which is not, again, a grand jury secrecy issue. She pled. There were documents that she's pleaded guilty.
Anybody who's, you know, connected here does hear those whispers, but, you know, as Sebastian said, the TU has done a masterful job of digging into the documents. You don't need to have, you know, anonymous leaks to deal with a story where somebody is, you know, pleading guilty to something.
These complaints by Corrine Brown, this is just a smokescreen. I mean, she's just trying to throw up smoke and confuse the issue here. The issue is, you know, basically, is the federal prosecutors going to move against her or not? And, you know.
Well, and while we wait to find that out, Fred Matthews, what about her point of view? As Sebastian said, there are other ways to serve an official with a subpoena than going into a barbecue restaurant.
This is politics, and the prosecutor decides and instructs the U.S. Marshals, in this case, to go serve this warrant. And I don't care where you serve it at. And she's a public official, longstanding. I mean, for those who are always afraid of politics, if you get into a jam like this and you get on the wrong side of certain people, these kinds of things can happen to you, which is why a lot of people don't run for office. But having said that, the referendum is this fall. It's this fall. It's going to happen either in August. I'm surprised we haven't had more on the campaign trail yet with this thing, because it starts in August, the Democratic primary, right?
August 30th.
So this could all be a moot point after that date.
And despite all of these challenges, Corrine Brown, as you've written, could still pull this out and win another reelection.
Oh, very easily. It depends on the timing. Or if there is no movement against her by the prosecutors, I believe she will win re-election. She's still very popular and very powerful.
And let's go to a few of your calls. Andy in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi. How are y'all?
All right.
I just want to make a comment about the public housing issue, and specifically when it comes to the Pastor Griffin's properties. I just want to note... the conditions of these apartments didn't suddenly appear overnight. So I think some of the responsibility should be placed on the residents. I mean, if they took pride, there's no ownership at stake here. And if they took pride, at least in the place where they lived, did, in my opinion, a minimal amount of cleaning, the unsightly conditions probably wouldn't exist. Now, I'm sure the apartments weren't dirty and run down when they were acquired or when the residents moved in, or else they probably wouldn't have moved in. I appreciate the tears of some of the people who've spoken and, you know, some of the people who've gone on camera, but honestly, maybe if they'd spent money on other things instead of gold teeth and numerous tattoos, some of these apartments would have passed inspection.
All right. I'm going to hang up on Andy, but go ahead, Tim Gibbons.
Well, that's a classic trope in dealing with public housing, the idea of, well, basically these people deserve it. If you talk to anybody who lives in something like this, the idea of them showing up and going, oh, the apartment's dirty, I'm not going to move in, when it's the only housing available, simply isn't true. When you don't have air conditioning, you get mold, not because you haven't cleaned, but because you can't condition the air. That's why most of us have it. It was honestly just a classic response to something like this from somebody who basically just doesn't think poor people should have a place to live.
Let's move on and talk to Dana in Mandarin. Go ahead, Dana.
Thank you. I'm calling about the plan to deepen the river for the Port of Jacksonville.
Yeah.
About a year and a half ago, I contacted my congressman to question this, because if the purpose is to increase the capacity for the port, deepening that river is not going to add one ton of additional cargo capacity to it. My suggestion was that we build an offloading facility into deep water. We can build a Buckman Bridge, 2 miles long, to deep water. These Panamax-ready ships can pull right up to it. They never have to leave the open ocean, and that will give us a competitive advantage against other ports that we are losing cargo to right now.
All right. Thanks, Dana. Thanks for that. That's an interesting thought. But, of course, whether or not that shipping channel will be deepened is still an open question, given the incredible cost associated with it.
Here's the real problem there. You can't put a railroad terminal out into the ocean. And without a railroad terminal, any Panamax terminal doesn't make sense. You can put it on dry land. That's why they're going to do it.
You're not thinking big enough. I mean, a floating railroad line.
Yeah, the floating nuclear plants idea is going to come back to Jacksonville.
But you've got to build the infrastructure out there to do it, and there's a price tag associated with that. So if there's a price tag, and I have no idea what that price tag would be, there's a price tag associated with that, I would imagine the people at the port would argue, why not just use that money? And to deepen is a really expensive project, $700 million to go 13 miles up the St. John's River, but why not use it towards that dredging? And you also have the key issue with TRAPAC, that is one of the largest, most prominent tenants out there, and they want the deeper ships. They said they can bring in the deeper ships, and those hold three times as much cargo as these other ships, and that's important for business and the future of the port out of Jacksonville.
And let's talk about another story that tangentially involves our port. This week, federal investigators announced that they found the critical black box that could tell them why the El Faro cargo ship sank off the Bahamas in a hurricane last fall. The 790-foot cargo ship went down on Halloween during Hurricane Joaquin after it left Jacksonville and shipped out to San Juan. All 33 crew members died, making it one of the worst disasters involving an American cargo vessel in decades, they used some pretty interesting technology. I don't know if you saw this, Fred, to find the data recorder. So at least they were able to do that.
I mean, that was really something else. Literally a needle in a haystack, and to find it there, to get a picture of it. So it's going to be a bit before they can get to it, I think, because of time. This was a technology center that basically use some new technology to find it. But the folks from the NTSB are going to have to take some time before they can go back to the site to actually retrieve it. So it could be, another month or so before we see anything. But it is really incredible. And it tells us a bit about the world we live in.
A needle in a haystack under 3 miles of water.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
That is a critical finding because, there's a lot at stake as to how the ship and what was the sequence of events were before it sank, because there are lawyers from here to Seattle, just itching to know the answer to those questions, as well as the family members.
What's interesting, a good chunk of the family member lawsuits have already been settled, so it will be interesting to see those who have waited if this has any impact.
All right, let's talk sports for a minute. Last night in the fifth round, the Jaguars nabbed Florida State cornerback Jalen Ramsey in the NFL draft. Ooh. Lots of fans turned out at FanDuelville for that at the stadium. The pick seen as a major win for the franchise, and Seminole fans obviously happy. Sebastian Kitchen, your thoughts?
No, I think it seems to be a win-win. I think the Jaguars appeared happy that Jalen Ramsey was still there at that point. There, obviously, some people thought he might go a little higher. So he's still there is good for the Jaguars. They could obviously use him on the defense. Although the Jaguars and most of these teams that pick early could use players in a lot of positions. So, he'll fill a role in it. And also, with his local connections, I think is a win-win.
Well, I was looking at the Cowboys last night. I'm sorry. But Tony Romo's going to stay quarterback as far as I can see. I mean, as far as the Jaguars are concerned with this draft, again, I'm looking – I don't know what we're looking for, be honest with you. Are we looking for a stronger D-line? Are we looking for better wide receivers? I'm not sure what we're looking for. And even with what we get, this is not a great draft year. So whatever we get – we're not going to know how it's going to work out until September.
Until they start playing. Exactly.
You can use somebody. Blake Bortles has been knocked down almost as much as any quarterback in the league the last couple of years. So I imagine he wouldn't mind if they picked up a 330-pounder to stand up there in front of him.
At least two of them that can move, yes.
All right, some other news and notes. It's another lively Friday here on the show. Did you see that Jacksonville this week made a Forbes list of surprising foodie cities? Other spots around the country that made this list were cities like Portland, Oregon and Houston, Texas. Our hot new restaurant scene played a part in the shout-out, so that's pretty cool. Speaking of restaurants, crews excavating the old Bostwick building on Bay Street to turn it into the new Cowford Chop House. Well, they turned up some amazing 100-year-old artifacts like birth certificates of the Bostwick family, jewelry, personal correspondence, and more. The finds are all being donated to Mosh so people can come out and see them. That's pretty interesting.
I thought they would have hocked the jewelry to pay for that. It's a really expensive project. They're putting a lot of money into it.
Yeah, they certainly are. But it will be exciting when that restaurant finally opens. And finally, it's our collection of strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous stories from the week from all around the state. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Okay, we've had a lot of water stories today. Here's another one. Only in Florida do people try to make it all the way to the Bermuda Triangle in what's called a hydropod. Yes, the Coast Guard had to pull 44-year-old Reza Bellucci, an endurance runner from Pompano Beach, from the waters of the Atlantic on Sunday after he ended his aquatic voyage to the Bermuda Triangle in a very strange contraption. He had set out in an ocean bubble. You should look up pictures of this. It had 36 buoyancy balls on each side. Bellucci was also equipped with a life vest containing a water filter, a GPS tracking device, and shark repellent. This was the second time he tried to do this. The Bermuda is more than 1,000 miles northeast of Pompano Beach. According to his website, Bellucci wanted to follow the 3,500-mile Bermuda Triangle.
I mean, that's like a lot of stepping on top of the waves. Did you ever see that thing? You have to run in it.
Yeah, exactly.
You run in it across
the water. Picture a gerbil on a treadmill. That's what he was doing.
The Coast Guard officially asked him not to do it, which I thought was kind of funny. The point where the Coast Guard says, hey, dude, no, maybe you back off.
But he did it anyway. Now, he was not a lazy guy, though. But only in Florida do we see not just one, but several major cities in our state called among the laziest in the nation.
Whoa.
Yes, the website Realtor.com recently named not only Orlando, but also I believe it's Miami and Boca Raton on the top 10 laziest cities in America.
We didn't make the list?
It seems we here in Jacksonville are a little more hardworking. We did not make the cut, so we can forget about that.
Maybe we did, and I just didn't read that for us.
That's a first. We make all those lousy lists.
Yeah, we did not make that one. But thanks to our media panel, they're always on my great list. Tim Gibbons, Fred Matthews, John Burr, and Sebastian Kitchen. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thank you. I'm going to bed.
We'll be right back.
Give mom the perfect gift for Mother's Day. A ticket to Girls Day Out. A day just for her to refresh, rejuvenate, and celebrate good health and wellness. September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. The day begins with breakfast, followed by exciting speakers that will engage and empower. A great lunch, swag bag, and much more. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
What happens when someone who hates welfare becomes the head of a welfare department?
I've seen so much damage to people that are on welfare. They have no hope for a better future. They aren't setting a good example for their children.
I'm Adrienne Hill. A new series that looks at what welfare is now and how it's changed. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, she's a former CIA operative and a nationally known author. Most of us remember Valerie Plame for her experience being outed by the Bush administration as a covert CIA agent. She's also the author of the New York Times bestseller Fair Game, which was made into a film starring Naomi Watts and Sean Penn. But what you may not know is that after Plame had twins, she struggled with postpartum depression. Plame will discuss her journey through that at an annual lecture series here at WJCT next Wednesday, one sponsored by Baptist Health. Valerie Plame gave us a preview. Let's listen. Valerie Plame, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot of anticipation about your keynote speech here at WJCT about postpartum depression. People know you as a former CIA operative and an author, but it's lesser known that this is something that you dealt with as a mother. Can you share with us a little bit about your experience?
Yes, I had twins, boy and girl, in January 2000. And I thought I was pretty tough and pretty independent, and I had had a very interesting career, and I absolutely was not prepared for postpartum depression. As a matter of fact, I didn't know really what I was experiencing. I'm blessed with a pretty upbeat disposition, so I just had no idea what was happening. Mm-hmm. And it's happened to so many mothers. You don't want to share that. You're ashamed. Everything is different. Your head is not working like it should. You're in total sleep deprivation. And everyone's telling you, oh, you're so lucky and you have such beautiful babies, which I did. Mm-hmm. It took me a while to get help, which I did finally do. And when I came out of it, I realized, wow, here I am. I'm highly educated. I'm professional. I had a loving family and husband. And this happened to me. I can only imagine if you have maybe don't have all of that support. So I threw myself into it, and that was 16 years ago. It's something that I still care about deeply. As we know, in general, the state of mental health help in this country leaves something to be desired, and I focused on this sliver of it because it's absolutely critical, not only for the mother's health, but for the babies and the family. And that's a foundation that if you don't get right early on, it's not going to get better.
Sure. And as you said, you had the support you needed. What do you think are the most important things that the medical community can do to better address this issue? Because 15 to 20% of all women experience this.
That's right. Here's the most important thing: being screened. Because the good news is, it is relatively easily diagnosed, and once diagnosed, in most cases, you can get help and be better. And so I think the most important thing, the medical community is slowly figuring this out. There's pockets of advancement, but there's still ways to go, which is adequate screening for the mother. Now, you see your OBGYN in the lead up to the birth, and then at 6 weeks postpartum. And by that time, for most mothers, that's when it's really settled in, except what happens is a lot of the books available out there just say, oh, it's just the baby blues, it's a little adjustment period, you'll be fine. But as you say, 15 to 20%, in fact, it goes beyond the baby blues. And so it's who do you see the most actually in those first few weeks is not your OBGYN, but your child's pediatrician. And the pediatrician tends to just be focused on his or her client, which would be the baby. But that baby's health and well-being is, of course, entirely dependent on the mother's health and well-being. So I would love to see a greater emphasis in pediatrician's office, screening the mother, asking the mother. Again, there is a great deal of toxicity and shame associated with anything that has to do with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you need to ask more than once. And I'm involved with a group called Postpartum Support International, and they've done a lot to breaking through that stigma and making sure that all the people surrounding and the new family, the new baby, are aware of this. But again, there's a ways to go.
Sure. Now, you're coming to talk, obviously, about postpartum depression, but people also know your name and face quite well from your time when you were outed as a covert CIA agent. You later wrote a book about that fair game that was turned into a compelling movie. Now you're involved in nuclear anti-proliferation efforts. It's interesting to hear you say that out of all the challenges you faced, postpartum was actually even more difficult than being outed at the CIA. Is that really true?
That's really true. Although that definitely threw me for a loop as well. My point being that I thought that I had my baby rather late. I was prepared, and it just had me on my knees. What happened with the betrayal of my identity was my CIA identity. That was just this bizarre, partisan-driven media circus that went on for quite a few years. But we moved in 2007. My family and I moved from Washington, D.C., where we were living, to where we are now in New Mexico. And we started to rebuild our lives. And one of the things I worked on in the CIA and I continue to be passionate about is nuclear nonproliferation, making sure bad guys don't get nukes. And in fact, I just did some events. I'm on the board of Plowshare Fund, and I just did some events for them. They were really instrumental in getting the Iran deal passed. So I'm delighted to be able to continue some of that work that I did in the CIA.
Well, it's a delight to speak with you, and we very much look forward to your appearance here in our studios at WJCT. Valerie Plame, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Valerie Plame speaks next Wednesday night here at WJCT. That event is free. Well, Theater Jacksonville travels back to the late 19th century in the name of riotous adventure with their new play, The Explorers Club, a comedic lampoon of an eccentric men's society that is torn apart over a very interesting question, whether to admit a woman member. Director Tracy Ann Olin and cast member David Guile join us now, and it's good to see you both.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for
good
being
be
with us. So this club is dedicated to scientific pursuits. It's London, 1879, but the crisis is over whether to admit a female member, yes?
Correct, absolutely. We have several intrepid explorers in our group. We have a botanist and a herpetologist who wears a deadly cobra around his neck through the entire show.
Oh, get out of here.
And we have a zoologist, and we have a biblical scientist, and we have the explorer who discovered the East Pole.
The East Pole. Very nice. David, who do you play in the show?
I play a character, Beeb, who doesn't come around until the second act. He was one of the explorers who got left behind and finds his way back and wants to seek revenge.
And so in addition to the gender politics, this sort of gives the audience a look at how this sort of society in London of that day, just what interested people back then and the culture of the time, right?
Right. You know, and all these guys, it's very interesting how they set them apart, being a botanist and all the different personalities. And one of the themes in there is one, the zoologist has a little guinea pig and the herpetologist has a cobra and they're friends and they end up having some issues and it's riotous.
It's a fun show, yeah.
It's a fun show.
And the woman that wants to join is very accomplished.
She is.
Right?
She has discovered the lost city of Pahatlabong. So it's kind of an Atlantis of sorts. And so she brings back a native with her. So who's blue? So
And I don't know, you don't want to give it all away, but does she eventually get to join?
Or I'm not going to tell you.
Don't want to share that secret. But she's more than qualified. So what are the reactions of some of the members about whether or not she should be allowed in? Does your character talk about that?
Actually, my character doesn't even get to meet her. I don't think she's on stage. But there is an interesting interplay between the biblical scholar or the biblical scientist, and he has definite opinions on this, which always make me chuckle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Theater Jax has a long track record of doing these really entertaining and shows that this one has been performed on Broadway. This is a show you won't get to see anywhere else. What's it like as a director to work on this project?
This project has been wonderful from the get-go. I read the script probably a year and a half ago. It was, I think, the second play that I read out of all of the ones that we considered going into the season last year. And I was just smitten with it from the get-go. It was one of the funniest things that I ever read. And so I went to our executive director, Sarah, and I was like, please, please let me direct this. And she finally did. So,
yeah, and it's on stage now. How's the audience been responding?
The audience has loved it. It's just so funny. I mean, how can you not love it?
You know, and Theater Jax, too, we always want to point this out when you guys are guests. This is the oldest running theater, continuously operated theater in the state.
Correct.
Which is so incredible. Right on the San Marco Square. If you've never been to a show there, make this your first one, the Explorers Club. It is running through May 7th. Get your tickets now, theaterjax.com. Thanks for giving us a few minutes, guys. We so appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for letting us be here.
Director Tracy Ann Olin and cast member David Gow with us again. It's the Explorers Club at Theater Jax. We'll be right back in a moment with blues great Mud Morganfield. That's next.
Is the space we live in, the space all around us, not really there? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for some philosophical physics as we explore the weird quantum world.
If you're not confounded or confused about quantum mechanics, that's because you haven't understood it at all.
It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The number of heroin-related deaths on the First Coast has more than doubled in a year. Law enforcement is pledging to clamp down on sellers as they urge users to seek help for their powerful addiction. In Community Thread, The Opioid Epidemic, we'll take a look at the factors drawing people toward the needle and the strategies our community is using to fight back. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be a part of our studio audience on May 10th.
On the next Fresh Air, Bruce Eric Kaplan, the New Yorker cartoonist who signs his work B.E.K. His memoir about his childhood has just been published in paperback.
I don't remember a time when I didn't think, why did I get stuck in this house?
He's also a producer and writer for the HBO series Girls. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Don't care how long you stay, 'cause good kind treatment will bring you home one day. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna trouble for me anymore.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, we've got a special treat. Mud Morganfield will perform tonight a free show headlining the Amelia Island Isle of Eight Flags Shrimp Festival. Morganfield is the eldest son of blues legend Muddy Waters, and he has carried on his dad's legacy with distinction, thrilling his many fans both across the country and overseas. We are so pleased to welcome Mud Morganfield to the studio. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
So good to meet you. Also in studio, Jeff Malone, president of the Amelia Island Blues Society. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So this is really exciting. You're headlining a show tonight. The Shrimp Festival's always fun every year, but you're going to be performing tonight. It's great to have you in the area.
I really appreciate that. And I want to say thank you to all the Shrimp Festival and Florida in general.
Absolutely.
My dad loved it here.
Did he?
Oh, he loved it here.
He loved Florida?
He met his last wife here in Florida.
Get out.
Yes.
Wow. So now you and your dad are so associated with Chicago especially, but there are blues fans all over the world that come out, and you're going to London, I think, after this show to perform.
Yes,
is that right?
I mean, I'm just amazed and thrilled that from Russia to Brazil that people have seen my dad there at some point. Amazing.
Yeah. And what's it like to carry on that legacy and build such a great career in your own right over the years?
It's a double-edged sword.
Is it?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I'd be compared to, and some say, oh, well, he's okay, but it's, you know, and it's okay. I was just telling you, one of your producers, that daughters marks their moms and men marks their dad. So it doesn't matter. I love it.
Well, but you know, Jeff, as you've pointed out, as head of the Amelia Island Blues Society, Mud has won a slew of awards and headlined the Chicago Blues Festival just last year, and it's quite a coup for you to bring him here to Amelia Island.
Yeah, we're really excited to have him back. He played our Blues Festival up in Amelia Island about 3 years ago, and then we had an opportunity to go see him in Chicago at the Chicago Blues Festival to celebrate his dad's 100th birthday last year. And we just love to invite everybody in Jacksonville up to Amelia Island tonight for Chicago Blues Night. It's going to be fun.
This is free. It's right in downtown Center Street on Fernandina Beach, right?
It is.
In the historic area.
That's right. There at the end of Center Street.
So when you perform, when you get ready to do a live show like this, a big outdoor festival, I think pretty loose, fun atmosphere. You want to bring the party to Fernandina Beach, right?
Yes, I do. I mean, I just want to bring the blues. And those blues lovers out there, they know who I'm talking to.
Yeah,
I just want to bring some blues to the festival. I think it's going to be great, and I want to say thanks to Jeff and all his team for making this happen.
Now, did you grow up knowing you were going to play the blues, or when did you decide I want to do what my dad did?
Well, you know, like I said, all sons mark their dads.
Yeah.
If Muddy had been a carpenter, probably be fridging with wood. So, I actually knew that I probably was tapping on my mother's stomach, probably.
Really?
All my life, I've had these music notes running through my head, and I didn't understand what they were until I understood who actually my dad was.
When? How old were you when you figured that out?
Well, I started playing drums about 4 or 5 years old, mm-hmm. and Dad used to buy me drums every year until I got to maybe 19, 20 years old, and then I picked up the bass guitar.
Yeah.
And I write my songs by the bass guitar now.
So you just grew up with music all around you all the time.
All around me all the time. I mean, great music, too. I mean, it wasn't the era that my dad come up in because it was the 30s and the 40s. Uh-huh. And I come up a different. I come up in the Motown era and the rhythm and blues kind of era. So, you know, I'm glad I was grounded in both of those.
Who else were some of your major influences?
Oh, I am a big romantic, and I have to say Barry White.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a big pushover.
You're a big softy?
I'm a big softy. Don't tell everybody.
You're a gentle giant, I can tell.
I mean, you know, life is so fragile. Till I enjoy every second I'm able to be here. So.
Well, it really is a treat to meet you, and it's exciting to get the advance on this big event. So, Jeff, let's give the details one more time for people that want to come out and see the show.
Okay, tonight he'll be going on stage at 7, and he'll play an hour and a half. So right at 9 o'clock we'll have fireworks. And so it actually starts, the Shrimp Festival starts today, and there'll be activities all day and then all weekend long. Gin Blossoms play tomorrow, and then they have a big act on Sunday. They always have Swinging Medallions, so it's gonna be a fun weekend, and the weather's gonna be great. Come on out.
It's the Shrimp Festival on Amelia Island as Mud Morganfield headlines tonight, a free show in downtown Fernandina Beach. Such a pleasure. Guys, thanks for coming down here to Jacksonville to talk about it with us. We so appreciate it, and have fun.
And thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
That's Mud Morganfield, and also with us today, Jeff Malone, president of the Amelia Island Blues Society. That free concert is tonight. And we'll close with a little more music from Mud Morganfield. Enjoy. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
Call home to you, all my friends. Get your home once more.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.